supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In Villanova and William and Mary. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up on today's show, a popular topic. When exactly should you plant your spring bulbs, and how do you protect tasty ones from squirrels, deer, and other outdoor omnivores? We'll have some new tips on doing just that in the question of the week. We're also going to talk to a horticultural architect who designs green walls, living walls for the insides of buildings. Lots of fun. That's a lot to do. So we better get right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you. It's so good to be here, finally.
It's so good to have you with us here, John. Where are you?
I am currently in Marlton, New Jersey. I just got back from Norway, Maine.
Right.
And Norway is between Paris and Poland.
So good. Did you have to have a passport for that trip?
You ought to, but they name their towns funny up there. That's
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, like Marlton's normal. Okay, sure, John. What can we do for John in New Jersey?
I have a problem that I've had for years and is driving me absolutely crazy year after year. I have a little plot of ground in back. I have a big plot of ground in back, but the little plot for tomatoes is absolutely perfect. It's about 4 feet by 8 feet. Beautiful soil. I get morning sun and great soil. I plant two tomato plants, and they grow to over 7 feet tall.
That's not tall for a tomato.
Well, it's tall for me because I can't reach that high. But what's happening is the first year I tried it, I staked it with these bamboo poles, and I had my little grandson behind it. It looked like a Vietnamese prison camp.
Uh-huh.
And it was really cool, and I'm tying it with string and everything, but I couldn't keep up with it, and it extends all over the place, and the vines fall down, and the tomatoes are all scrunched, and it drove me crazy. So then somebody told me that what you got to do is, since tomatoes grow laterally, you got to put in your bamboo or something, poles, and then put something in the middle to hold the tomatoes. Well, I tried that, and that's impossible,
cause
and they grow too long. And then I tried staking, I tried a trellis, and it goes beyond the trellis. You can't even find the trellis. I don't know how to stake my tomatoes. I get 100 pounds of tomatoes. How do I stake my tomatoes, Mike?
Do you want the good news?
Or
the bad news?
The bad news? Give me the good news.
The good news is that if you had gone to our website and looked in the Garden Answers A to Z under tomatoes, in and among the 30 different tomato articles we got in there is a detailed one on how to make really easy tomato cages out of animal fencing. You buy like a 25-foot roll of animal fencing, cut it into 6-foot long strips, turn the strips around until they form a cylinder, tie the edges together, generally with parts of the cage wire itself. Put those in the ground with your tomato in the center, and then your stake goes through the sides of the cage to hold it into the ground. Since the tomato will fall over to the side, it'll lean into the side of the cage, and it'll wrap around the inside of the cage as it grows up. By the time it gets to the top of a 6-foot-high cage, it'll have used up 3/4 of its length already. It'll have used up 7 to 9 feet. So then it can begin to cascade over the side. All your tomatoes are in the air off the ground. It makes for very easy picking, very easy care. And if you make the cages out of just regular animal fencing, when the tomato season is over, you can take the cages, fill them up with shredded leaves, and by the time you get to springtime and you're ready to reuse the tomato cages again, the leaves on the bottom will have become compost, and the uncomposted leaves on top will make a great garden mulch. Now you're ready for the bad news. How long have you been growing tomatoes in this same plot?
For about 5 years.
Okay, you are out of time.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. You must be growing disease-resistant tomatoes for it to have held off this long. But even in the best organic soil, tomatoes will build up a soil-borne wilt if they are grown repeatedly in the same spot. As we move further south, fusarium becomes the predominant wilt. Where you are in New Jersey, it's probably all verticillium. But what you will notice, if you haven't noticed it already, you may just think this is normal because it's the mild case doesn't look that bad, is the lower leaves on the tomato plant start to turn yellow, and the yellow progresses up the plant. If you do not rotate them, you've heard about rotating your crops. Most of that is good garden practice, but not necessary. But if you don't rotate your tomatoes to other parts of your landscape, you will get the wilt, and then once it strikes, every year after that, it will be worse and worse. And if you continue this for, say, another 3 years, the plants will be dead by July of that season. You must have experienced yellowing of the leaves at the bottom at this point after 5 years.
No, I haven't.
What variety are you growing?
I think it's Better Boy.
And you buy the plants in a store, you start the seeds?
Yeah, I buy the plants in the store, and I change the different varieties every year. I'll go a Big Boy, and then a Better Boy, and then a Rutgers, and a, you know, whatever they have. Like.
Well, the Big Boy and Better Boys, I believe, are both hybrids and probably both bred for VF resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But I really do urge you to move them to a different spot next year. Grow something else in that spot for 2 years. And then, heck, if you've got this green thumb where the wilt just doesn't seem to want to hurt you, then go back and do another 4 years in this bed. But be aware that it's going to come and get you. And you've probably established a record of avoiding it so far.
I'm a very lucky guy.
All right, John, you go out, continue to be lucky, make your cages, and have fun.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Don, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's great to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, Don. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Columbia, Maryland, just south of Baltimore.
I know it well, the planned community.
Yes, that's right.
What can we do for Don just outside of Baltimore?
Well, we have a 25-foot-tall maple tree on our property. We have a long driveway, and it's down at the end of the driveway near the street. The tree is probably 18, 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Most years, along about mid-October, its leaves turn this beautiful golden yellow, and then they come down in early November, something like that. That's most years. But this year, about 2 weeks ago, I think, the tree started to shed its leaves like crazy. Most of the leaves on the ground are brown and wrinkly. Some of them are still green, but they have what looks like huge human age spots on them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I didn't really notice that the leaves were falling, but my wife ran in one day and said, "I think the tree's dying, it's dying." So I went out and I looked at the branches, and I see plenty of big green buds on them. So I'm thinking maybe it's not dying, but I said I would call you and see if I could talk to you and find out what's happening and if we need to be worried that the tree is actually dying.
Okay. Has anybody been using herbicides near the tree?
No.
And has there been any construction near the tree?
No.
Well, then all the news is good. I've been hearing a lot of reports up and down the East Coast, but oddly enough, mostly in what I call the extended Washington, D.C. area, of trees dropping their leaves super early, and of course before the leaves have a chance to turn color. Even though this kind of spoils your dramatic show for this year, this is a natural stress reaction that the tree uses to not die. Now, you know that your tree went through two horrific summers. First, it went through the hot and dry summer of death, and then it went through the summer of endless 7-8 inches of rain a week, week after week.
Right. So, and because this is at the end of the driveway, it gets a lot of water. It's not just water under the tree. It gets water that comes down the driveway, too. So it was pretty sopping.
I've had some tulip poplars behind my house that started dropping their leaves in July. They were so fed up with this summer. There's many reasons why deciduous trees drop their leaves. One is to reduce plant competition on the forest floor. When they drop those whole leaves, it smothers the plants underneath them, which is why I tell people if they're going to use leaf mulch, they have to shred the leaves. Otherwise, they're laying a tarp over their precious plants.
Yeah.
But the other is so that the tree doesn't have to expend that energy in winter keeping these leaves alive and dealing with the temperature changes. When trees drop their leaves, they seal themselves off from the outside world, and they send all their energy down to the root system, and it stays down there until it's time to wake up again in the spring. When we have this kind of a wretched summer, either too hot and too dry or just too wet and windy, it's perfectly natural and normal for a healthy tree to react by shedding those leaves early and keeping its energy reserves as intact as possible. So you can imagine what it's like to be a tree in a summer where you got both those things right on top of each other. So this is totally natural and normal, and I predict your tree will leaf out beautifully in the spring. Absolutely no permanent damage. And if anything, it's a sign that your tree is truly healthy, because an unhealthy tree would not be able to manipulate its leaf drop like that to protect itself. All right, man?
Thank you very much. That's a comfort to know.
Yeah, that's one less thing for you to worry about.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right. Very good. Take care, man.
You too.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn everybody in a climb where it's chilling down that there's still time to perennialize your precious pepper plants. Dig them up carefully, pot them up well, rinse their leaves repeatedly, rinse their leaves repeatedly again, and then bring them indoors to your brightest light. But don't go herding your habaneros just yet, because we'll be right back with how to build a green wall, how to protect your tulips from squirrels, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Penswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Penswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
Your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting, supports WHYY. I'm Eric Frame, President. Details at yourparttimecontroller.com. Your part-time controller, building stronger nonprofits, one accounting department at a time.
And this reminder, WHYY's October membership drive begins on the 13th, and you can listen pledge-free on YStream. For details, head to whyy.org/YStream.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is almost spring bulb planting time. We'll tell you the exact right time to plant spring bulbs. We'll also have some new and interesting ways to protect your tasty bulbs, that's tulips and crocus, from outdoor varmints like evil squirrels and voles and groundhogs and all those other things that want to eat your tulips before they can bloom. But now, as promised, it's time to bring on our special guest, Denise Eichmann, who is a certified landscape professional and a senior project manager for Ambius, a design company in Chicago that works with plants. And Denise is here to tell us all about green walls, a fascinating topic. Denise, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm just going to jump right into this. I know a lot of our listeners are used to hearing about green roofs, and your company, Ambius, is based in Chicago, right?
That's correct.
And I know at least up until a year or two ago, Chicago was the green roof capital of the United States, that they had leapt into this kind of horticultural technology early in the game. I think most people misunderstand the concept of a green roof because we see in all these Hollywood movies, people have penthouse apartments that are luxury landscaped up there. But in over 90% of the cases, closer to 99%, you don't walk on a green roof.
That's correct. Usually used for the environment in terms of reducing the amount of heat that's used in the buildings and air conditionings. It's like a thermal blanket on the roof.
And really what it is, in the simplest sense of the word, instead of shingles, you've got millions of small plants up there.
That's correct.
But the ideal green roof is one that's it's just there, right? It's just going to be like a weed. It's just going to thrive up on top of this building.
Right. A lot of the green roofs involve different types of sedums, or they involve different types of grasses that are low, very low water requirements.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want to be mowing up there. That would, you'd need Spider-Man to come in and
yes,
do the
mowing. That would be difficult.
Was it a straight line from green roof technology to these panels of green material? And I understand there's green walls both indoors and out in different locations.
That's right. There is both indoors and out. And there's a number of different types of systems. But the basic technology did derive from the green roofs. And so basically taking that same concept and putting it vertically on a wall.
But gravity is not your friend anymore when you're doing a wall, right?
Right. What happens with most green walls is it's a modular system. And so what happens is that most of the time we're using a substrate that's not a soil media. It could be a foam media, could be coconut core, could be a rock wool system, but almost always all hydroponic.
Well, I was going to say, when you talk about rock wool, you're talking about the classic medium that plants are grown in hydroponically.
That's correct.
Let's talk about one of your indoor green walls. I believe there's one you're very proud of that you designed, installed in Chicago recently.
That's right. There is a green wall in downtown Chicago at the Embassy Suites, the lakefront property. That project basically is in the sky lobby of that particular hotel, and it's a double-sided wall. And it actually is a conversion because it was an existing water fountain that years ago no longer was working. And so we got the idea to convert this into a double-sided vertical green wall.
So a sky lobby is a hotel lobby that's not on the ground level.
That's correct. This is on level 5.
Okay. And there used to be this big water feature, you know, piece of stone maybe with water pouring down it.
Right. It was a large monolithic structure with water, like a sheet of water pouring down the sides.
Right. Very typical for hotel designs in lobbies of really nice hotels. What made people decide to put in a green wall? Where did green walls get started? I believe green roofs got their start in Germany.
I believe that green walls, from what I understand, the first green walls that we've seen have come from Asia. I mean, so much of those areas, those cities are so heavily populated and there's so much structure. So to be able to combine nature and live plants, you know, with the materials of building construction is just phenomenal.
Now, years ago, I stayed a tremendously pleasant surprise. I was put up at the Opryland Hotel in Nashville. I was there to judge the Nashville Flower Show. There were these lavish indoor gardens, 5 of them, down the center of the hotel, each the size of a football field, including a Mississippi Delta. And the rooms were all wrapped around them so that all the rooms were on the outside of the hotel, and the inside was this series of gardens that beat out a lot of botanical gardens I had been to in major cities. And I saw how it changed the whole relationship of being inside a hotel. So you've taken one of these things and you done flipped it sideways.
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about Opryland because all 3 of those gardens were actually my projects. And it's
really?
Our company that installed those. Yes.
Well, a fabulous job. I stayed next to the bromeliads, the tropical garden, and just, you know, was astounded to walk down to it one night, find it was full of tiny little frogs living in the bromes. And it was just, I don't think there was ever a bar fight in that hotel. Because there are birds flying around, and it's just a tremendous feeling.
It's a phenomenal, phenomenal environment there.
So are green walls a continuation of this in a more limited space, perhaps?
They are. I mean, it's interesting because you can take all this foliage and textures and colors and just add them to the side of a surface of a building. And, you know, not only is the environment enhanced in terms of the reduction in heat and adding humidity to the air, but plants really draw people in. And you'll see that when you see a vertical garden in public space. You'll see that people are just drawn to the wall. They have to go to it. They have to touch and feel it. They have to get their picture taken in front of it. It really rolls out the welcome mat.
And so you're standing there saying, get your hands off my plants.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm going to ask the obvious question. I'm an obvious kind of guy. You know, I can tell you right now that if I built a green wall, there'd be a lot of dirt and plants on the floor very quickly. What's holding these puppies in place?
Well, actually, it depends upon the system that you're using, but commercially, the systems that we use, the plants are pre-grown into the panels. So they're grown flat on the ground in the nurseries, usually down in South Florida is where they originate. And so you're starting with little plants that are like 2-inch plugs. So there's a very small amount of soil. And then that root system is growing into the growing media, meaning the cocoa fiber or the rock wool or whatever substrate is used. So there's a minimal amount of soil. Now, there are green wall systems that do have soil in them. And actually, the one that's at the Embassy Suites is a soil system. But
now, when you say soil, I presume you mean more soil-free mix, like I advocate for container plantings.
I mean, in that particular case, what's happening is that the plants are actually staying in their nursery containers, and they're sitting within trays that are being flooded, like the way that greenhouses are flooded in Holland, the flood-and-drain method of watering.
Sure.
And that is how that particular system is watered.
Are these plants, you said it's modular, so is every section replaced every couple of years as the plants kind of age out? Or are these plants that can, like, just go on forever and not need deadheading and never get too big, kind of like the ideal children that no one ever had?
Well, all plants need grooming and thinning to keep them alive, but it depends upon the section, you know, the selection of plants that we use.
And what do you use? What's the ideal plant for a green wall? And before you say that, let's talk, what size is this green wall in Chicago?
It is 10 foot tall and 80 feet long.
So we're talking almost 1,000 square feet.
That's right.
This is a big puppy. What's in the puppy?
Well, we have all different types of tropical plants in there, anything ranging from philodendrons and pothos, which are your common house plants, to different types of ferns, rabbit foot fern, maidenhair fern, and then we bring some color and texture in by rotating in begonias. And so those plants are the ones that would be changed out every couple months. But the things like the philodendron and the rabbit foot fern, those are permanent plants that will be in there forever.
Are there pipes going in and out of this to bring it water and nutrients?
Well, in this particular case, we had the existing fountain. So we had
the benefit
of water already coming
Cheater.
To the wall. Yes. But in most cases, yes, we need a licensed plumber to bring us water to the green wall and then drains to carry that water away.
And I would presume in a perfect system, this water would be recycled.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because the new type of system now is one that recirculates water. So basically, the water comes in from the building supply, and then it's recirculated using pumps and using UV filters to clean the water from any type of bacteria.
And you say there's one at Longwood Gardens, too.
Well, the interesting thing about Longwood Gardens is the green walls are actually the restroom pavilion. So they took this long spine-like corridor.
So now we know where the nutrients are coming from.
And it has a beautiful skylight over the top, and it's like walking through a fern grotto. It's almost all fern.
And, of course, Longwood Gardens, for those outside of the area where we record our show, Longwood Gardens is in Kennett Square, PA, down in that horticultural ghetto of endless fabulous botanic gardens in the Brandywine Valley, and is probably the premier botanic garden in America. Can green walls be freestanding? I mean, because I presume the one in the hotel is viewed from both sides.
That's correct. There are green wall systems out there that are freestanding, made kind of like a billboard-type structure. And I think you're going to start to see them more and more in airports because they're being used for advertising.
But that would be a great way to freshen up the air, lower blood pressure, help you get through the horror of the American airport today. I've always loved is it Chicago or Atlanta where you go underground and you have the neon light
show?
That
is Chicago, that's correct.
And that's just, you know, I mean, that's very technological. But how nice would it be when you're on one of these endless moving walkways to suddenly you know, be surrounded by begonias on both sides.
I think that would be phenomenal. That would be great. You know, the other area I think that really would take off with green walls is healthcare and hospitals. Because we all know
that blood pressure down.
That's right. We all know how therapeutic plants are. And there's been numerous studies that have been done to show that plants actually reduce the recovery time for patients. And patients just have a better outlook when they're surrounded by greens.
We've been talking to Denise Eichmann, certified landscape professional, senior project manager and design expert for Ambius, a company in Chicago that's heavily involved in the design and installation of green walls. And we will post some pictures of Denise's green walls and other people's green walls and maybe some information about how you can build a little green wall in your own home at our website. Denise, thanks very much for coming in and being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Pleasure to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Jack. Where are you, sir?
My garden is in North Carolina. I'm on the road right now in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
And we're about 10 miles from like a big corporate farm. And my neighbor had called me over, and he was having some of his corn. He was having 4 ears come out of one leaf. I thought was extremely unusual, and we started looking around on the internet about the hybrids and the genetically modified, and we killed the plant because we didn't want to infect other ones. And my question to you is, do we have to be worried? Because if the Terminator gene comes in and infects your crop, that's what basically I'm worried about.
Right. Well, there's two things that could be going on here. Your friend is growing sweet corn, right?
Yes.
And the corn being grown near his garden is presumably field corn being grown for animal food or industrial use.
Yes, sir.
So long before anybody was gene jockeying plants, the word went out that home sweet corn growers have to be careful not to try to grow a sweet corn near a field of field corn. Corn pollen does travel large distances. And if it is, as you say, a giant farm that goes on for acres and acres, that pollen is filling the air and it is dropping into the tassels of his plants. What typically happens then is you get plants that do not taste good. You get sweet corn that doesn't taste as good or that doesn't prosper. But what you are fearing actually does occur. Farmers, I'm sorry, man, but it's true. The vast majority of corn grown industrially in the United States is one form of genetically modified corn or another. Now, typically, my understanding is most of it is Roundup Ready corn. You know, when genetically engineered crops came out, the big lie was that, oh, we'll reduce pesticide use. But the main type of genetically engineered crop is actually engineered to survive massive levels of herbicide use. It's a huge problem for people trying to get organically certified, because obviously if you have genetically engineered pollen hitting your corn, you're going to be in trouble. So the old advice, because this has always been a problem when people are growing sweet corn at home, they have to make sure it doesn't cross-pollinate with other corns in the area,
right,
especially if they're in a farming area. Try to time the pollination of your corn. That's when the tassels on top are dropping their pollen down into the corn plants. You try to time your tasseling so that it does not cross over with the other corns in the area. And if he sees when they're planting and just talks to the guys and finds out the days to maturity of their corn, he might be able to avoid that. Otherwise, you try distance and you try to grow your corn on like the other side of a building, on the other side of a windbreak. But if he wants to avoid growing corn that has the Roundup Ready gene or the Terminator gene, and he can find out if he's got the Terminator gene just by saving, you know, letting a couple of his ears dry so the seed becomes viable, and then replanting
right.
them. And it's my understanding if it is Terminator genetically engineered that he won't be able to germinate the plants. But his best bet is to buy fresh seed every year. Don't save any seed, so at least he's not passing along any of these genetic traits that he's picking up. You know, if it's a small crop, when he sees the other corn tasseling, he could throw row covers over top of his tassels and then go out there and bang them with a broom gently a couple times a day. Then all the pollen is going to drop down into his corn, but the risk of contamination would be low. But this has always been an issue with corn, even before genetic engineering. It's a very frisky pollen, and it's very easy to have other people's corn affect your corn.
Well, hey, Mike, I really do appreciate it. I mean, it's a little unnerving, some of the stuff you said. But, yeah, I definitely will take that to heart and really do enjoy your program, man. And thanks for the information.
Thank you. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being unnerved by genetically engineered plants. This is one of the biggest health risk experiments unsupervised in human history.
Rock on. Thanks, man.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn our listeners that time is running out in most climes for garlic planting and the overseeding of cool season lawns. It's prime time to give cool season lawns their biggest feeding of the year as well. And it's time to have a blower vac at the ready to suck and shred as many precious fall leaves as possible. But don't go making that list and checking it twice just yet, because we'll be right back with how and when to plant your tulip bulbs and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
This is WHYY. It's 11:38.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Highlands Mansion and Gardens in Fort Washington holds their annual Craft Show Garden Restoration Fundraiser until 5 p.m. today and 10 to 4 tomorrow. You can celebrate the first shots of fall color, enjoy locally grown food, and try your hand at making a Harry Potter scarecrow at the Morris Arboretum's Fall Festival tomorrow from 11 to 3. There's a native plant sale today and tomorrow, 9 to 3 each day at the Unitarian Church in Bethlehem's Historic District. And there's a free workshop on worm composting at Rutgers Earth Center in New Brunswick this coming Wednesday evening beginning at 6:30. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Later today on Fresh Air Weekend, actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt and writer Will Reiser join us to talk about 50-50, a new romantic comedy loosely based on Reiser's not-so-funny experience with cancer, diagnosed in his mid-20s. At the time, Reiser was a writer on the British import comedy series The Ali G Show, along with Seth Rogen, who also stars in 50-50. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today here on WHYY. The forecast for today, few showers expected, the high temperature in the mid-60s. Right now it's 62 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll discuss spring bulb planting time. When is the ideal time to put those bulbs in the ground for that fabulous show next spring? And how can you protect tasty tulip and crocus from voles, rabbits, squirrels, evil squirrels, well, they're all evil, and everything else that wants to eat them before you can see their bloom? We'll tell you how right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Arlene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Yeah, I'm from the Northeast Philadelphia, and you offer great knowledge to people. On last week's show, you said that grass-fed poultry is more nutritious than grain-fed. It produces folic acid, and it tastes better. I asked a person in the meat department at Whole Foods if they have grass-fed, and he said poultry does not eat grass. My question is, where can I purchase grass-fed poultry?
Well, you're talking about the interview we did with Joel Salatin, who is a legendary rancher, beyond organic farmer in Virginia. And, you know, your friend is a little bit right, Arlene. When we use the term grass-fed to indicate an animal that was raised at the highest level of food, nutrition, and respect for the animal, we're generally talking about beef, cattle that are allowed to roam on the grasslands as opposed to being fed grain, because cattle stomachs were never created to process grain, and it ferments in there. There are many people in both the farming and the medical community who believe that the E. coli epidemics from beef are entirely due to feeding cattle grain, which their stomach can't process. And you won't get E. coli in animals that are allowed to roam around free and eat grass. Poultry is a different story. Chickens and turkeys, in their wild form, work the soil. They do eat grass, they do eat weeds, but they also eat a lot of bugs. They're out there scratching and pecking, and they're true omnivores. But what Joel was talking about is chickens or turkeys, you mentioned, that are allowed to roam in pastures out in the fields, and they will do what these birds do naturally, which is to spend most of their day with their heads down in the dirt and their feet scratching at the dirt, and they're eating seeds and they're eating green plants and they're eating bugs and weeds and weed seeds, and they're eating everything. And that's the birds, I believe Joel was talking about the folic acid content of the eggs that he gets from those birds just being off the charts compared with regular eggs. Now, we are really talking, and this is something I tried to get across, and I don't think I did a good job when we talked to Joel, that this is the highest level of gourmet food, that this is the local food movement, that this is food that is raised by local farmers, people you can meet. So really, the answer is probably you're not going to find it very often at even the highest end chains like Whole Foods. You're going to find it at local farmers markets and food co-ops. Now, I'll tell you, I live out in the Lehigh Valley near Allentown, and we have many farmers markets and producer-only farmers markets out there, and it is there that I buy my chicken. I buy it from a woman who farms in Pennsylvania. Her name is Jean Nick. She has a place called Happy Farm, where she raises her chicken out in the open fields in the grasslands. And to answer your earlier question directly, yes, Jean will sell you whole chickens, or she'll sell you the same kind of processed parts that you could buy in a store. But I will tell you, it's going to be more expensive, and it is a little bit harder to find. But I would even say, you going in to Whole Foods and saying, has this store ever considered buying local chicken from local suppliers?
Oh, I truly appreciate your answering my question. Thank you so very, very much.
Oh, Arlene, it's a great question. Thank you for asking it. Well, good luck, Arlene. I hope you meet a local food provider, and I hope you get a chance to try some of this pasture-raised chicken. You won't be sorry.
Oh, I'm sure I won't be. Thank you so very much.
Our pleasure. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, Scott. Where are you, man?
Havertown, Pennsylvania.
Very good. Just outside of Philadelphia.
Yep.
What can we do for Scott in Havertown?
I have a backyard that is all green, but probably a good third of it is clover and a few weeds that I can't identify. I don't have a very green thumb.
Okay.
And my wife and I are very concerned about using chemicals in order to control that. We have a dog and some young children. So what we want to do is figure out what we need to do to prepare for the winter time, so that when the spring comes around, hopefully we're in a much better position to have a more lush thick yard of regular grass.
The first thing you said is it seems to be full and green. Is it ritually important for you to stand over certain sections, look down and see one kind of plant over another?
No, but it would be a sense of pride to know that my yard is consistent with my neighbors who seem to have managed to have a pretty good lawn of the regular stuff.
Pride should come from doing good work for the poor, raising your children well, not beating the dog. All right, here's the deal. Have you fed your lawn yet for the fall?
No, I've only limed one time.
And why did you do that?
I was told it was the right thing to do to return the soil to more of a neutral balance.
But your problem isn't pH. Your problem is your lawn is underfed and overwatered, which is indicated by the clover. Clover is a sign of a lawn with poor drainage that's overwatered and underfed. So luckily, you are talking to me at the right time of year. There's still plenty of time to give your lawn its fall feeding, which is the biggest feeding of the year.
Okay.
You can either get a big load of compost delivered, dump it on the lawn, and rake it in until you can't see the compost anymore. That would also improve your soil structure. You can get a couple of bags of corn gluten meal and apply that at 10 pounds per 1,000 square feet of turf, although that's essential that you do that in the spring. Or you can just get any bagged organic lawn fertilizer. Don't use high nitrogen lawn fertilizers. I mean, I don't think chemical lawn fertilizers. I don't think anybody should do that. But especially this late in the season, it would be an especially bad idea.
You did make a mention about a lot of poor drainage.
Yeah.
It's at the bottom of a very slow tapered valley, if you will. So mm-hmm. when it rains, that's where everything goes. And we even have a drain in the underneath of the yard. A dry well.
Yeah, but are there drain tiles throughout the lawn to carry the water to it?
No, there's not.
Yeah, see, the lawn, if you're in that kind of low-lying area, drain tiles should have been installed when the lawn was, but
right.
people rarely do the right thing. Then I'm going to tell you the best thing you can do, if we can get to a dry stretch this fall, is to rent a machine called a core aerator. And pull plugs out of your lawn. You can do this before or after the feeding. It really doesn't matter. You may need to corate every fall for a couple of years to lessen the soil compaction. Knowing that water drains up, knowing you have poor drainage, that leads me more, if you're willing to do it, to do the compost feeding.
Okay.
But as long as this drainage issue is not addressed, you're always going to get clover.
Oh.
And that's the reason between the difference between your lawn and your neighbor's, quite likely.
Right.
So you want to aerate your lawn in the fall, probably for a couple of years to help with the drainage. You want to feed it heavily in the fall, but naturally. And then in the spring, as soon as the local forsythia or red buds start to bloom, you want to have corn gluten meal in hand. You don't want to go out and start looking for it then. And put down 10 to 20 pounds per 1,000 square feet of your turf. That will prevent any new weeds from sprouting, and it will also give your lawn a good spring feeding. In addition, never cut your lawn below 3 inches. Never cut your lawn when it's wet, and you should begin every year with a blade that is brand new on your mower or that has been newly sharpened.
Fantastic.
All right, man?
Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Good luck. Thank you for making it, Scott.
Take care.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, planting and protecting spring bulbs. Our question this week comes from Donna in Marlton, New Jersey, which she describes as just a few minutes away from the Pine Barrens. She writes, "Mike, I adore spring bulbs and have planted them many times, with little success thanks to moles. We've seen their holes. One year I planted 40 red tulips and only one tulip bloomed. Same with daffodils. I have had success with a few crocus, or are they croci, planted near our front door. They bloom every year. Is it hopeless to plant other bulbs? Can I grow spring bulbs in pots? Any advice is greatly appreciated." Well, the first thing I had to tell poor Donna is that any moles are innocent. Moles make long tunnels in the ground whose top portions are visible, often disturbing lawns, but they don't eat plants. Moles, like most teenage boys, are 100% carnivorous. They'd starve before they'd eat a plant. Quote, "holes in the ground can mean voles if the holes are small, or groundhogs if the holes are large. Evil squirrels, sorry, that's redundant, are also notorious for digging holes, and they're the number one cause of disappearing spring bulbs. Donna wrote back, quote, "If I were Homer Simpson, I'd have to say, doh. We have lots of squirrels in our fenced-in backyard. A fence," she notes, "that had beautiful copper finials every few feet before the squirrels gnawed them off." Donna continues, "I feel foolish. I had no idea that squirrels ate bulbs. I thought they were too busy eating the birdseed that fell out of our feeders. I apologize to my moles." Well, don't feel bad, Donna. It's a common mistake. And your response provides my first piece of advice. Stop feeding seed to your birds. As you note, it's attracting the squirrels that are making mischief with your bulbs. It's also providing food for voles, shrew-like pests that are the second biggest enemy of spring bulbs. Voles are the opposite of moles, total vegetarians. They're more like girls in their first years of college. Their appetites are enormous. They breed prodigiously, and they flourish in yards with spilled bird seed, as do mice and rats. So switch to feeding suet this fall and winter, and if you really want to continue feeding seed, you must buy spill-proof and squirrel-proof bird feeders. Now, to provide you further assistance, I also reviewed the basics of good bulb planting and protection with my old friend Sally Ferguson, director of the Netherland Flower Bulb Information Center. First, some basics. Don't plant bulbs too early in the season. No matter what the big sign says at the garden center, the ideal time to plant spring bulbs in most regions of the country is after Halloween, but before Thanksgiving. Don't feed your bulbs at planting time. Next year's flowers are already formed deep inside the bulbs. Feed them after they bloom in the spring to charge up the following year's flower. And pick a site that has good drainage. The Native American spring bulb, known as quamash, is the only spring bulb that can handle wet soil. Now, on to spring bulb protection. Sally reminds us that the number one way to deter voles, squirrels, and deer is to plant bulbs they won't eat. Tulips and crocus are delicious and nutritious. Everything eats them. Almost all the other spring bulbs, daffodils, allium, fritillaria, are either toxic or just plain taste awful. Yes, squirrels will sometimes dig up daffodil bulbs and replace them with black walnuts, because squirrels are evil, but they won't actually eat the bulbs, like that helps. Equally important, stresses Sally, is to clean up your bulb trash when you're done planting. Quote, "Leaving brown scraps and bulb wrappers on the surface of the soil is like putting up a sign that says, tulips planted here, come eat. Clean up completely after you plant. And if you want some insurance, spray some deer repellent on the surface of the soil to disguise the smell after planting." Now, Sally actually prefers to brush her dogs over top of the newly planted bed and scatter more dog hair on top after every brushing. All of the pests that attack bulbs fear dogs, and there's probably nothing more repellent than mulching your bulb beds with some dog hair. Sally also suggests planting the tasty bulbs as close to your house as possible. Most animals prefer to plunder plantings at the outskirts of your property, as your crocus experience seems to confirm. Just don't leave pet food, garbage, or other animal attractants nearby. Or, she adds, think about spot planting some tasty tulips inside clumps of non-edible bulbs like daffodils. At least make the squirrels work for their dinner, Sal notes sardonically. And finally, she says yes to your pots. In fact, Sally is a big proponent of planting bulbs in containers, at least in Zone 7 and higher. Use a big container, the bigger the better, and keep the bulbs close to the center of the container, away from the edges. Position the container in a sheltered area, like near a corner of the house, and screen the top in a way that prevents squirrel intrusion. Those long-tailed servants of Satan just love to container garden. Now, Sally uses what she calls expando screens to achieve this, those portable sliding screens that fit into the bottom half of a storm window. She puts a couple of rocks on top to keep the squirrels out. I prefer chicken wire tucked down the inside of the pot as deeply as I can get, also with rocks on top. You can use other forms of protection. Just make sure the bulbs can receive rainwater. Or try the technique we described a few weeks ago for growing garlic in a container. We'll provide a link to it with the online version of this question of the week. Well, those sure were some great tips on actually enjoying the tulips you'll be planting next month, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read our excellent advice in detail, with links to lots more info about spring bulb planting and protection, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to throw me to the squirrels if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line. And it might save you a lot of time and energy if you check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Special thanks this week to the wonderful Sally Ferguson and her partner David Karras, whose contracts with the Dutch bulb growers will expire in December after 23 years of providing fabulous, fun, and faithful advice on spring bulb to garden wretches like me. Tulips will never seem the same, Sal. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Don't Call Me Merv Griffin. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. We will do everything in our power to prevent squirrels from swapping black walnuts for our Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We heartily hope that our intern, Julia Worski, will reliably return as well. Our editor, Al Banks, is so mean, he scares the squirrels. I'm bulb-protecting Mike McGrath, and unless I crocus, I'll see you next week. Are regular morning glories invasive or just pretty plants? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss why so many neighbors fear the sight of purple flowers in the sky. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike painstakingly helps us prepare perennials, pears, parsnips, and more for the upcoming cool and cold weather seasons. Join us at 11 Saturday mornings for You Bet Your Garden here on WHYY.